ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Patricia Carvelis here. I'm the host of the Politics Now podcast, and I spend a lot of time talking to politicians, usually grilling them. But over summer, I want to introduce you to the people behind the politics.
People think politicians love talking about themselves, but it's not really the case.
I genuinely am not actually going to... I'm not going to name any names.
Why not?
No, I'm not.
You can find the interview series in the Politics Now podcast feed.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. So technically, I am still on holidays. I have another 2 weeks of leave, in fact. But at precisely 8:35 p.m. on Saturday evening, when I was thinking about not Venezuela, I got a text from my producer, Cara, and it was about Venezuela. Hi, Cara.
Hello. I am sorry for ruining your holidays.
What was it that you sent me?
It was a screenshot of a Truth Social post where Trump had claimed that he had captured the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, and that they had been bundled onto some sort of very covert plane and blindfolded and were being transported to New York to face drug charges. And so it was a screenshot of this and then just a lot of exclamation marks.
From you, to be clear, not from...
That's right. He also probably had some exclamation marks, but I had more after the screenshot.
Yes, you didn't finish it off with thank you for your attention to this matter.
That's true.
President Donald J. Trump, as he tends to sign off all of his Truth Socials. Now, this is undeniably a very big news story, shocking
yes.
even. But really, I shouldn't have been shocked because this week we are planning to begin rolling out a giant series that we've spent literally a year planning for. And every time at this show we decide to spend a long time planning for a big series and set a date for it to come out, something very, very big happens in the news. You weren't around the two biggest times this happened, Cara, but right before we were going to launch a series about Russia and their meddling in Ukraine and Europe, the Mueller report came out literally the weekend that we were planning to launch that series. And then Russia invaded Ukraine the week before we were going to come out with a series about Australian climate policy. So I should have seen it coming, but I didn't, which is ironic considering what our big series is about. And I'm sure that you will also laugh at the irony once you know what that big series is about.
Yes.
Anyway, we are still going to be bringing that to you this week. But first, we do have to talk about Venezuela. Cara, what was your reaction when you first saw the news about what had happened to Nicolas Maduro?
So I feel like my mind went where maybe not a lot of news people's minds went, and that was instantly to Batman and specifically The Dark Knight, the movie, which is where I have gleaned pretty much all my knowledge about how extradition works, illegal extradition.
That's what that movie is mainly about. Extradition law, yeah.
Exactly.
This is actually oddly relevant, I think.
Yes.
And I'm glad that you brought this up, this story from The Dark Knight. Cara, run us through what happens in that section of The Dark Knight for people who can't remember or who haven't seen the movie.
So it's a fabulous film if you haven't seen it that I definitely recommend. But basically what happens is the Joker has an accountant called Lau who is located in Hong Kong, and he's basically, obviously because he's this mob accountant, has broken a lot of American laws. The problem is for the American authorities that they have no jurisdiction over this guy operating in Hong Kong because there's no extradition policy between Hong Kong and the US, or China as well, and the US. The police say, look, there's nothing we can do. Despite the police owning a big light that basically says, Batman, we need your help. Batman doesn't work for the police. The Joker famously says Batman has no jurisdiction. So Batman comes up with this elaborate plan to basically like fly to Hong Kong secretly on this kind of covert plane, stand on top a building that's near the building where Lau is doing his kind of financial operations. Then he kind of Swan dives into the building, kicks the glass in.
Explodes through this guy's wall, yeah, like the Kool-Aid man.
Fully. He blasts through. There's not a lot of people there because obviously no one's expecting somebody to blast through floor 57 of the skyscraper that you're in. So the police get the call. They're running up the bottom. Batman obviously knew this was going to happen. So he grabs Lau, puts this like little belt around him. The belt sends up this balloon that can then attach to this covert plane that's flying black over, and it works. I don't know how it works. Some sort of magnet clip, and clips them both.
It's just a hook, I think. I think they just hook it.
Maybe it's just a hook. They hook him and then they fly out, and then he, you know, the next day is delivered with a sign around his neck. At the LAPD.
Gotham.
He's famously the name of the city. Delivered to Gotham, to Jim Gordon, and they put him behind bars, basically. Batman's done the dirty work for them.
So Batman yoinks a man out of a building in Hong Kong.
Exactly.
Because the police don't have any jurisdiction over Hong Kong and can't go and get him.
Correct.
And this, I think, is oddly relevant here to the entire situation that now exists in the post-Maduro capture world, whereby the Americans used to kind of pretend that they couldn't go into foreign countries where they don't have extradition laws and yoink people out of those countries on an aircraft.
Yes.
And they didn't have the ability to do that legally. Whereas what's happened here, effectively they're saying that they think that Nicolas Maduro broke American laws, drug smuggling and that kind of thing. So they have conducted what they describe as a US law enforcement operation to go into a foreign hostile country, grab the man who is serving as that country's president, and yoink him out of there on a helicopter against his will, like Batman.
Yes.
You know, in the Batman movie and in all of these things, like there was this whole idea that the Americans couldn't do that. Like, when Julian Assange was inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, they didn't send in SEAL Team 6 to burst in through the wall of the Ecuadorian embassy and then just disappear up into the sky. But apparently now,
all bets are off.
All bets are off.
You can just do whatever you want.
The American government will come and get you for breaching American laws, even if you are in countries that have no extradition policy. I mean, people have fled the United States to Venezuela because Venezuela doesn't have an extradition policy with the United States. So is the US just going to be plucking people out of other countries now? It's an extraordinary thing that they have done here, an incredible shift, I suppose, partially in, you know, US law and the implementation of US laws. The Delta Force is Batman now, apparently.
Yes, that's true.
So, I mean, it's an incredible thing that's happened. Did you see it coming, Kara?
It was kind of on the bingo card for me, but so was almost everything else.
Kara's bingo card is the size.
It's Epstein files, it's Venezuela. It's
a tablecloth-sized bingo card.
It really is. And we're right at the beginning of the year, so plenty of time to play.
And we kind of, in some ways, predicted that something like this was going to happen when we made our first episode about Venezuela last year, which was specifically regarding the potential for the US to use a playbook that they had written a long time in the past, in the late 1980s, in fact, where they seized Manuel Noriega, the dictator of Panama.
All of these objectives have now been achieved. The United States is committed to providing General Noriega a fair trial. Those charged with promoting the distribution of drugs cannot escape the scrutiny of justice.
Now, there are some key differences between what's happened in this case with Maduro and with what happened with Noriega, but there are also a lot of similarities. So we're going to bring you an updated version of the main part of our episode that we did about Manuel Noriega last year, which looks at some of the key similarities between what is happening in Venezuela and what happened in Panama in the late 80s. And after you hear that, Kara and I will be back at the end to talk about what might come next. On the night of the 13th of September 1985, 18-year-old Costa Rican farmer Franklin Vargas was looking for some of his escaped chickens. He lived in a small town, just a few hundred metres away from Costa Rica's border with Panama. Franklin couldn't find the chickens and started to head home when he saw something in a creek under a wooden bridge. It was a pair of human legs. They were poking out of a large US mailbag, which was submerged beneath the water. Franklin ran home and told his father, who told the police. What they pulled out of the bag was the decapitated body of a very tall white man. It was quickly determined that the very tall white man was Dr. Hugo Spadafora, Panama's most famous opposition leader.
The violence to Hugo Spadafora's body was quite simply an outrage. He'd been tortured over several hours and then slowly decapitated while still alive.
His head was never found. And it wasn't long before the Panamanian people decided who was responsible. The country's dictator, General Manuel Noriega.
Almost immediately, General Noriega was blamed for Spadafora's death, in part for a curious personal reason. Hugo Spadafora was a very handsome man and a deep personal rival of Noriega's. Many Panamanians believed that only the general would have wanted Hugo Spadafora so deformed in his death.
General Noriega had been bullied his whole life for his pockmarked skin. He had been known from school days right up into adulthood as Cara del Piña, or Pineapple Face. Spadafora, by contrast, kind of looked like prime Elvis Presley. But Noriega's looks and, frankly, very unpleasant demeanour hadn't stopped him from gaining power. He had never had to win a popularity contest. His mentor, the handsome and charismatic General Omar Torrijos, had led a military coup in 1968 and become the de facto leader of Panama. Noriega had succeeded Torrijos when he died, and he had all the charisma of a busted piñata. But he didn't need to please any voters. He just had to retain control of the army. And for that, he had a lot of help.
General Manuel Noriega, head of Panama's defense forces and de facto ruler, was a vital US ally on the payroll of the CIA. But Noriega was also an ally of the cartel, according to all the available evidence.
When she says cartel, she means the Medellin cartel, led by the kingpin of all kingpins, Pablo Escobar. With the world's most powerful drug lord and the CIA behind him, he simply appointed puppet politicians to run the civilian government.
The presidential candidate, backed by both Washington and General Noriega, won the election amid widespread allegations of fraud.
Noriega's relationship with the US was crucial. At the time, Panama was split by the Panama Canal Zone, a US-controlled strip of land which straddled the Panama Canal. It was full of American troops and served as the headquarters of the United States Southern Command.
Under the Reagan administration, Southern Command became the nerve center of Washington's war against communism in Central America.
From there, they trained US-friendly armies from El Salvador and Honduras, and the Contra rebel group that they hoped would be able to topple the left-wing government in Nicaragua. Everyone, from Noriega to the Contras, was involved in the drug trade. But
Washington saw the war on communism as more important than the war on drugs.
This was what Dr. Hugo Spadafora was trying to tell the world about.
He claimed that Contra rebels fighting to overthrow the Nicaraguan government were trafficking cocaine, and that General Noriega was aiding and protecting them.
This was what got him killed by Panamanian military intelligence. Now, a US ally ordering the grotesque killing of a political dissident may not be a big deal for the current US administration, cough, cough, Jamal Khashoggi, cough, cough, but back in the 1980s, it was too much.
This series of events resulted in a rethinking of the situation within the administration and a very strong effort on the part of some people, particularly in the White House, to get the administration to adopt a different attitude towards Panama.
They would rather their puppet dictators didn't hide decapitated bodies in US mailbags, thank you very much. They began to pressure him to step down. The Panamanian people began to oppose him more publicly, demanding that he follow in the footsteps of other toppled US-backed dictators.
After Marcos of Filipina, the next one is Noriega of Panama.
He refused to go, which put everyone in a bit of an awkward position. There was possibly no dictator on earth more vulnerable to US intervention than Noriega.
6,000 U.S. military and civilian Defense Department employees and their families live in Panama City.
U.S. Southern Command HQ was walking distance from his house. Within 10 kilometers of Noriega's headquarters, there was a U.S. naval base, a U.S. Army base, and two U.S. Air Force bases. His only hope was that international disapproval of U.S. imperialism would be enough to keep the Americans inside those bases. But what if instead of an invasion, the Americans could just claim it was a police operation?
In a virtually unprecedented move, a court in the United States has indicted Panama's military ruler for drug trafficking.
Nobody would be upset if they just went into Panama to arrest some drug lord, right?
General Manuel Noriega faces charges of using his vast powers to convert Panama into a safe haven for international drug traffickers. It's unlikely he'll ever be brought to trial.
Well, we'll see. This was the first time the US had ever done this, indicted a sitting leader of a foreign nation for a crime. Generally, the heads of state of foreign nations have immunity from US law. But the US argued that this did not apply to Noriega because he wasn't technically the president of Panama. In response to the indictment, the guy who technically was the president of Panama, Noriega appointed puppet Eric Arturo Del Valle, turned on Noriega and tried to sack him. Noriega arranged for Del Valle to be replaced.
But opposed President Del Valle, still in hiding in Panama, effectively called for United States military intervention.
We are sending a brigade-sized force to Panama to augment our military forces already assigned there. If required, I do not rule out further steps in the future.
President George H.W. Bush said the additional troops were only there to protect the Americans stationed in Panama. As more and more American troops poured in, Noriega took the bait.
Noriega declared his military dictatorship to be in a state of war with the United States and publicly threatened the lives of Americans in Panama. That was enough.
That was enough.
Just after midnight, American troops struck dozens of targets simultaneously from one end of Panama to the other.
The US quickly defeated the Panamanian army, and then they went looking for Noriega.
The US has offered a $1 million reward for his capture.
What followed was a geopolitical Benny Hill sketch. The world's greatest superpower went hunting for old Pineapple Face.
Many believed he was hiding in the jungle, organizing resistance.
In each of Noriega's houses, they found piles of cash, hardcore pornography, and cocaine. Oh. Actually, turns out the cocaine was just flour for making tamales. Still, lots of cash and porn. They eventually figured out that Noriega was hiding somewhere he definitely wasn't allowed to bring his porn stash.
Mr. Noriega had presented himself at the papal nunciariate and turned himself in for political asylum.
The Vatican Embassy. The Americans couldn't go in and get him, and so they decided to encourage him to come out.
The sound of raucous music filled the air, carried from loudspeakers set up by soldiers, perhaps to irritate the people inside.
The loudspeakers were broadcasting the US military radio station SCN.
Good morning, Panama!
The people here are calling for justice, but Noriega can't hear their cries. He's still being deafened by rock music, the tune currently playing, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, Nowhere to Run.
For 3 days, the station opened their phone lines and accepted requests for what songs to play for Noriega. They played Judgment Day by Whitesnake, No More Mr. Nice Guy by Alice Cooper, Crying in the Chapel by Brenda Lee, and Prisoner of Rock and Roll by Neil Young.
The racket outside the embassy clearly angered the Vatican, who called it American harassment.
But apparently, even Jimi Hendrix / and Angus Young can't shred hard enough to make a dictator hand himself in. They eventually packed up the speakers and reverted back to traditional diplomacy. 10 days after entering the embassy, Noriega was handed into US custody.
Noriega looked tired and nervous. Surrounded by drug enforcement agents, he was then handcuffed and shackled.
He spent the rest of his life in prison in various countries and died in 2017. In that time, Panama became one of Latin America's most successful democracies and gained total sovereignty of the Panama Canal from the US. And nobody is talking about taking that back at all. At least they haven't been talking about it for a few months. This is one of very few examples of the US successfully and quickly overthrowing a dictator and creating a new thriving democratic state. And there now seems to be a push to repeat the trick in Venezuela.
Venezuela Maduro, the dictator there, has already been charged for drug smuggling. And who did that happen to? Hello, Noriega, Panama.
And all the same language used by the Bush administration then to do that is exactly what's being used now.
And look, while there are differences between Noriega and Nicolas Maduro, there are also some key similarities. To start with, Noriega became the dictator of Panama after the death of his mentor, the charismatic revolutionary Omar Torrijos. And Maduro, his charismatic revolutionary, was Hugo Chavez.
Mourners gathered in the streets to grieve the man who led their country for 14 years. Opponents derided him as an old-style Latin American dictator who squandered the country's wealth. But many will mourn his death. An election is expected to be held within 30 days. His vice president, Nicolas Maduro, is the likely frontrunner.
At Chavez's funeral, his allies from Iran, Cuba, Russia, and China were guests of honour as Nicolas Maduro openly wept at the death of his mentor.
Venezuela's acting president was overcome with emotion. He described Hugo Chavez as pure and real and alive forever.
Maduro transitioned from acting president to actual president via a very close election in 2013. Like his mentor Chavez, he's no fan of the United States, and we might look into the reasons for that in another episode. But this episode is about the methods of American intervention in other countries rather than the morals of those interventions. At first, the US pressured Maduro's regime by imposing economic sanctions. That was until he was re-elected in 2018.
The Maduro regime's cruel manipulation of the democratic process to further enrich a handful of supporters at the expense of the Venezuelan people.
The official results of the 2018 election showed a landslide victory for Maduro, but the US and its allies did not buy it.
We in the UK believe that the election in Venezuela was flawed, that it was fraudulent.
In Venezuela, there were massive demonstrations.
Once again, Venezuelans have taken to the streets, hoping to bring down President Nicolas Maduro.
In the midst of the protests, the Speaker of the Venezuelan Parliament, Juan Guaido, declared the election invalid and appointed himself as the acting president.
I formally assume the duties of the national executive as the president of Venezuela.
And that's when things started to get very weird.
Joining us in the gallery is the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. Mr. President.
The US and its allies all recognize Guaido as the real head of state.
Please take this message back that all Americans are united with the Venezuelan people in their righteous struggle for freedom. Thank you.
The Trump administration even started talking about Maduro in the past tense.
Today I'm here to talk about the former Maduro regime.
And they charged him with drug crimes.
The indictment of Nicolas Maduro and his co-defendants alleges a conspiracy involving an effort to flood the United States with cocaine.
When asked how they could charge a foreign head of state with a crime like this, the Attorney General Bill Barr said...
Well, first, let me just say that we do not recognize Maduro as the president of Venezuela. Obviously, we indicted Noriega under similar circumstances. We did not recognize Noriega as the president of Panama.
Bam. I mean, Maduro still is very much the de facto president of Venezuela, but sure, you can pretend someone else is in charge if you want. But also...
The State Department has offered a reward of $15 million for the capture, for the conviction of Maduro.
2 months later, a group of American guys tried to collect that reward by rallying a group of Venezuelan expats to try... And they've been captured.
Authorities in Venezuela say they have detained a pair of American citizens working with a US veteran who has claimed responsibility for a failed armed incursion.
It may not entirely surprise you to hear where the guy behind this operation was based.
What we know is that it's a US-based security company in Florida and that he was acting on his own.
We actually did a Tuesday episode about that Florida man, and it was an absolutely riotous, crazy story. And while that attempt to invade and seize Nicolas Maduro may have failed, the US Army's Delta Force has certainly succeeded in a very Batman way. It was a far cleaner operation than the Noriega operation, as far as I can tell. There was no need to coerce him out of a safe house using any classic rock tunes. In fact, we still don't know all of the details of what happened here, but as opposed to with Noriega, where they were basically required a massive invasion operation with ground forces operating throughout the country and overpowering the Panamanian army, in this case, it was a very surgical strike. But we don't know all the details of what happened in this situation.
And as well, what happens next? I mean, we've had Trump come out and say that he's going to be charged in New York and that the US will actually be running Venezuela for the next little while. And then already there have been some members of the Republican Party that have tried to backtrack what the US running Venezuela looks like.
Yeah, well, even his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is going, oh, no, that means we're going to basically just coerce the new government run by Maduro's vice president into kind of doing what we want. They'll be doing all the work. We'll just be sort of telling them what to do. But then Trump's come back and go, no, we're running it. We'll be running it.
We'll be absolutely running the place. So we'll be, I guess, seeing what that looks like. And as well as that, I've been reading articles about people lining up for hours and hours already waiting for food, for water supplies, fearing, you know, what the next couple of weeks are going to look like. And then, of course, what this entire story means for the future of international law and whether we've entered this kind of Batman realm where America can more openly do whatever they want.
Yeah, well, I mean, as we talked about in another episode last year, they have a real history of shortages. And so it's totally understandable why, as a period of turmoil begins, you've got all these people going out there trying to stock up on essentials because they're worried about what might be about to happen and what the government will be able to provide for them in a country that really relies a lot on the government being able to provide for them, a job that it has manifestly failed to do over the last few years. In terms of international law, I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see whether this is the beginning of a new era of great powers doing literally whatever they want with very little pretext, or whether this is just sort of a formalization of the world that we were kind of already in. I mean, Russia arguably was trying to do this kind of thing to Vladimir Zelensky when they invaded. They were arguably just trying to topple his regime, grab hold of him or kill him, put in some sort of a more compliant government. I mean, obviously, now that the United States has done this in this way, their ability to argue that Russia is doing the wrong thing is a bit more limited because they've done something almost identical, if, you know, admittedly a bit more successfully. And of course, you know, there's a million questions recently about international law, whether it exists and whether anybody actually is going to bother following it. We did an episode a year or so ago about the impotence of the International Criminal Court and their inability to bring people to justice. Yeah. So, yeah, it'll be very interesting to see what this changes, both locally in Venezuela, whether they're going to enter a period of stability like Panama did after the Noriega toppling, or whether they're going to descend into some sort of Iraq sort of a situation where it's decades of chaos. It's terrifying to imagine what's going to happen in Venezuela. Mm. We will take a bit of time to figure out what it all means, and we'll let the dust settle a little bit before speculating. In the meantime, we do have a four-part series about to roll out. It's called Black Swans, and it's all about why you shouldn't predict the future. And we have a special preview episode coming out on Wednesday, and then the first main episode of Black Swans will be coming out on Thursday. We'll see you then.